When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Language on the Move podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bryn Quick, and I'm a PhD candidate in linguistics at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. My guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Peterson. Elizabeth is a senior university lecturer in the Department of Languages at the University of Helsinki in Finland. Today, we're going to talk in general about her research into language ideologies, and in particular about her 2020 book entitled Making Sense of Bad English. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Can you start us off by telling us a bit about yourself? How did you become interested in linguistics in general and language ideologies in particular? And on that note, what exactly is a language ideology?
Okay, well, I'll start with your first question, which was a little bit about myself. I'm an American migrant to Finland. I've lived here for about 20 years. I did my PhD in the United States, and I live in a home with three languages, Finnish, Swedish, and English, because Finnish, of course, is the de facto and also the constitutional majority language in Finland, but Swedish is a constitutional language with about 300,000 speakers, and my family fits into that category. So language is all around. I'm a strong advocate of multilingualism, and those are the principles that we try to espouse in our home as well. Practice what you preach.
I absolutely agree. In my house, we have not so much languages, we have two dialects. We have American English and Australian English. So not so much the language spectrum, but we definitely have words where we'll say them and ask each other and say, what do you mean by that? I don't know that word. Still 15 years on into this multi-dialectal relationship.
Isn't that incredible?
I know, right? And can you tell us, for people who might not know, what is a language ideology? What do we mean when we say language ideology as linguists?
Yeah, well, let's start with what an ideology is. And an ideology, in its most basic sense, means a belief that you have. So there are many really good definitions of language ideology that are coming out of linguistic anthropology, pretty much. And then we kind of borrowed all of that into sociolinguistics. And so an ideology is a belief, therefore a language ideology is a belief about language, a really deep-seated belief. And this is a basic definition that comes from somebody like Michael Silverstein, for example. There's many definitions that I like. I'll kind of keep it brief today so it doesn't turn into a classroom lecture. Nobody's interested in that. But another kind of nutshell definition that I like comes from the linguist James Milroy, who says that it's common sense views about language. So these are things that we kind of don't question, and we just think that it's always been there, that this is just the way it is, and therefore it makes it really, really difficult to turn that around and present it back to people in a way that they're willing to go, oh, so you mean that might not be an absolute truth, that this is just what I think? And so truth, of course, is a really negotiable concept. So just because it's what people think doesn't make it true. But, you know, it's complicated. That's what we need to present back to people, is that this is much more complicated than they might think. And also link it to concepts and realities like language discrimination, which they might not be able to make that link on their own. So that's one thing we can do as linguists, is to make that link for them.
That is such a good point, that there really is that link between language ideologies and discrimination.
And it's not a weak link, it's a strong link.
100%. Exactly, exactly. And kind of on that note, one of the first things that we as sociolinguists learn is something called the three circles model proposed by Braj Kattru. That's one of those sociolinguistics 101 things that we learn. But not everyone who's currently listening to us is a sociolinguist. So Can you tell us what the three circles model is and what it has to do with how people perceive different varieties of English?
Sure. And let me, maybe I could start a little bit by just talking about who Khatru was. He was from the subcontinent. He was from Kashmir originally. He just died a few years ago. So, you know, he grew up in a colonial setting, speaking English as a second language. And his idea with creating that model was to empower people from settings like that and not keep putting them down and saying that their English was somehow substandard or a learner variety or whatever. So it was a way of him taking ownership for people who come from that kind of a demographic and that kind of a geographical setting with a colonial history. But anyway, I presented this many times in class. So if you could visualize with me, if you will, three concentric circles, it looks like a bullseye with three circles, right? And Khatru's idea was that the inner circle, and that's what he actually called it, the inner circle is comprised of people who live in geographical territories where English is, you could consider it the mother tongue, the native language for the vast majority of the population. And English is used in all domains, most domains anyway, you know, family, maybe there's always some exceptions. We all live in multilingual societies. That's just the reality. But anyway, you can see what I mean, that it's mostly English. And furthermore, the way English got to places that are included in that inner circle are places where we had settler colonialism. Okay, and that's a key distinction there. So tends to be white people who came from Europe, brought the English language with them. They took over, they settled there, and became dominant in many ways, right? So this is what happened in Australia. This is what happened in the United States. Furthermore, these people from the inner circle, because of the history that they have the power in today's world, and it's been like this for many decades now, people would even probably say centuries, that they have power over the English language, that there's this sense that it really belongs to them. So we call this the norm-providing circle as well, that people, I'm from the United States, Brynn, you're from the United States, we have the privilege of being able to tell other people, oh, this is how you should speak English like me. So we get jobs in Japan and Korea and stuff like that, and nobody really questions it. It's just like, oh yeah, you're the native speaker. You know everything about the language. So, okay, that's the inner circle. Let's now contrast that with the outer circle. So picture the ring. Okay, we're moving on. There's the next ring in the bullseye. That's the outer circle. And these are places that have a colonial history. So here we're talking about real overt multilingualism, where English is an additional language, which is usually formally acquired. That means they learn it in a classroom, sometimes from a very early age. But more often than not, the home language is something different, or there might even be two or three home languages. So the outer circle is really characterized by strong multilingualism. But English is considered this elite language, which is learned in formal contexts, and it's associated with sort of this colonial history. Okay, so power coming that way. Let's see. Oh, and even though we wouldn't necessarily consider this a learner variety because it's so ingrained and it's been there for so many centuries, in some cases already, there's still this tension that, okay, do we look to the UK or do we look to the United States to tell us how to use this English? And there's a real divide that way, that in some places they are looking for that model. And in other outer circle settings, it's very much like, yeah, we got this. Thanks. Thanks for giving us English. It's ours now. Just back off. Right.
Exactly.
So these really localized ones. Yeah.
It's pretty exciting. I love that explanation. And I know that there is this real, like you said, tension between the circles that are in that bullseye and this idea of, well, who, quote unquote, owns English?
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Who does English belong to, especially since it has become such a powerful language in the world?
Absolutely. There's still one more circle, if I could just briefly mention that, Brynn, and that's the expanding circle. So that's the outside ring, and it's called the expanding circle because that's where a lot of the action is. So the inner circle, the outer circle, those populations tend to stay pretty stable. And I didn't give any examples of outer circle varieties. I just realized that. But here we're talking about places like Nigeria, India, Pakistan, right? Okay, in the expanding circle, we're talking about the rest of the world. And those are folks who learn English as a foreign language. And even that is such a kind of nebulous, confusing concept in today's world, because here I am in Finland. I tell you what, English doesn't feel that foreign here in a lot of settings anymore. So these labels, I really want to emphasize that they are not fixed. And that's actually one very big criticism of this model, is that we have these labels in this way of understanding Englishes, but it certainly doesn't tell the whole story.
Exactly. And that is such a big point for us all to consider, is that it's not fixed, and it often feels like it's becoming even more rapidly not fixed.
Oh, in this globalized absolutely. World. It is all over the place. There have been several subsequent models. And I know that some people consider this model a little bit old fashioned, but you know, for this exact book, what I wanted to do was to set up this tension between these kind of settings. So I liked it more for a heuristic device to just get people to think. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is because as a migrant to Finland and to Europe, it became very evident to me that there was this complete disconnect in many ways between what people in the inner circle think about English and what people in a setting like Finland think about English. And I wanted to connect those dots for people about the ideologies in particular. So this concept of the three circles model became a way to do that.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. And continuing on that, a lot of people who do speak English as their first and often only language, so the people in that inner circle that you were talking about, they might not be aware of something that's called the standard language ideology. Can you talk to us about what a standard language ideology is, and in this case, particularly in regard to English, and how it might manifest? And what I love is that in your book, you talk about what this ideology has to do with Santa Claus. Can you tell us about
that? Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, thanks for that. I'm glad there's a fan of the Santa Claus metaphor in the book. I wanted to make an analogy, so that I chose the Santa Claus. But yeah, let's get to that in a moment. First, I'll answer the first part of your question about standard language ideology. So we talked about language ideology basically just being deep-seated beliefs or common sense everyday views about what language is, and not really questioning what those beliefs are. So a standard language ideology means that people don't question the standard. They kind of have this idea that it's always been there. It's kind of funny, as if it would have been some kind of divine origins, that it's got some kind of almost supernatural force, that it's always been there just intact and beautiful. And in the book, what I really want to point out is that, hey, we have these standard varieties of English, which have cultural, historical, and social prestige in many ways, but it's nowhere near the whole story. It's only one variety of English, or some would say that, you know, there's several standards. Like, there's a different standard in Australia than there is in the US, for example, or different standards even, plural. But people who really, really espouse to this standard language culture, they tend to think that that is the whole language. There is nothing else. And when it comes to English in particular, come on, this is a language with, what, 1.5, 2 billion speakers in the world? You know, the estimates vary a lot, because we have to first define what it means to speak English, but that's a different story. But do you really want to tell me that a language with up to 2 billion people has one variety and that's a standard? Come on. You know, but people think it's the only valid standard, and that that's what we should all be aiming to achieve. We should all talk like that. But just how boring that would be if everybody in fact did that. And part of it's interesting and a little bit sad, actually, to think about how English got to this status through, you know, exploitation and colonization and so on. But what we have now is this treasure trove of varieties. And to try to think that we should all be speaking the same way and using English in one way. Oh, how boring, how terrible. No, there's so much diversity, and we can celebrate that diversity, but that's not enough. We need to also recognize that there are these divisions. And I used the term before, linguistic discrimination, about these different varieties. So yeah, that was kind of, I kind of got ahead of myself, but I really want to emphasize that there are actual drawbacks and challenges involved with having this kind of a language ideology.
Absolutely.
You asked in particular about the Santa Claus analogy that I used in the book. And yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And I will tell you that this was a contentious topic when I was proposing the book and when—
Oh, really?
Because the reviewers for the book were other academics, other linguists, of course. And there were— this book proposal was reviewed by 14 people, if I remember right, something like that. And a large majority of them were saying, really, you want to write about Santa Claus in a linguistics book? But I tell you what, Bryn, this was a book where I swallowed my academic ego, because this book is for students. It's for people— Yes. —who don't know about linguistics. And I really wanted to bring it to a level that everyday people could understand and it would resonate. If I haven't done that, I haven't done my job here. So I thought long and hard about what could be an analogy. And the point that I wanted to make— so you're talking about, I think it's chapter 3.
Exactly.
Chapter 2 even. Anyway, I wanted to show that what we consider now as standard English actually has a birthplace in time, and that what we consider the standard is man-made. It's not divine. I use these words before, like there's this idea that it's divine and that nobody can touch it. It's just so like, like this
sacred.
It's this sacred thing, but it's literally man-made. And I really do mean man-made, because it's been the people in power, the people who have the most social power, who have decided how we should speak, what's considered correct. And it doesn't necessarily make a lot of logical sense, but it's that way because they said it should be that way. These rules that we adhere to in standard English. So I went back to any language that has a standardized variety, it's always connected to having a written variety in that language, a written standard. So I took the history back to the printing press in the 1400s in London, started there, and then went on about how then spelling became fixed and so on and so on. So, and this is the same trajectory for any language that has a standard variety. Anyway, I did the same kind of— let's go back in history, because, you know, for me as a person from the U.S., as somebody who comes from a Christian background, Christmas, Santa Claus, these kinds of things that we celebrate as families, they're seen as the same way, that, well, this is just what we do, and it means so much, and this is our truths. And I compared it to folklore, actually, in the book. I have some nice quotes in there from the field of folklore. We believe it because we think that it's the way it's always been. But in fact, you can trace the thread back. And that's what I did. It was really fun research to go back and realize that, oh, you mean our contemporary conception of Santa Claus only dates to the 1800s in New York City? Like, what? You know, the red suit, the reindeer, all of that. It literally dates back to one poem. 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. And then it just exploded, just like the idea of a standard language ideology does. So getting students to make that connection and realize that these are man-made phenomena, and therefore they are not fixed, they're not divine, and we can do something about it. We don't have to just accept this. We can question this. We can mold this ourselves.
And that's what I loved about the Santa ideology. And I love how in the book, because as you said, it really is such a resource for not just students, but also teachers, professors, anyone, especially who's teaching undergrad or an intro to sociolinguistics course. And in the book, when you talk about the Santa Claus story and how that then became the standard because of that poem, you also say, and if this particular folklore doesn't apply to you and your culture, or—
That's right.
—do the standard language that you're thinking of, think of anything else, because we all have these types of stories in any culture—
right.
—that then take off and become the quote-unquote norm that we all just, like you said,
that we unquestion. Yeah, I was concerned that that would be kind of too Western-centric, and even, the Christian overtones there with this Christmas thing. But in the end, I went with it. But yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because I definitely don't want to be exclusionary in any way. So the same kind of concept could apply to, for example, how you celebrate weddings or any kind of ritual, any kind of holiday like that.
Anything with
Yeah, doesn't
tradition.
matter if you're Muslim or Jewish, whatever, or any kind of social group or lifestyle that you're part of. They all
Exactly.
have these kinds of manifestations.
Anything that feels like it's just always been right.
Exactly.
Exactly.
That's the point.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And I like too that you just brought up the idea of we get this idea of the standard language ideology, particularly when a language becomes written, because in the book you do take care to point out that there are so many languages in the world that are not written, that are oral languages. And you have, I wrote it down, a quote in the book, and it says, "Indeed, there is a common fallacy that the best, quote unquote, speakers of English should speak English like it's written. In other words, a written form of a language is a prerequisite for standardization, which in turn is a prerequisite for prescriptivism about a language." And I just think that that's such a valuable thing to keep in mind, especially when we talk about prescriptivism and people saying, well, you can't say XYZ because it's not written like that. But in the book, you really do take care to point out, but there are so many languages that aren't written and therefore don't go through this standardization process.
And it's really ridiculous if you look at English spelling. I think I say that in the book as well, that really, you want me to pronounce this like it's written? Are you sure? Because English spelling is so chaotic. It was such a chaotic process, really. So it was haphazard. And now I think it's quite funny, actually. I'm sorry if this offends anyone, but the idea that being able to spell in English is a sign of intelligence, and there's these spelling bees and everything. And it's like, wow, that means that you can memorize really well, but there is no logic. There is no
100%.
logic in English spelling. None.
My background before I re-entered academia was as a teacher as English as a second language or a foreign language. And I often told my students, do not be upset that you're not remembering how to spell these things. Remember, English is basically four languages standing on top of each other wearing a trench coat. And it makes no sense.
Like that.
So definitely don't feel bad if you can't spell these absolutely bananas words in English. They make no sense. I agree. And kind of on that idea, thinking about people who are coming from those sort of outer circles, your book has a section called When, quote, bad really means, quote, foreign. Can you tell us about how and why people perceive someone's English to be, quote, bad or wrong, and sort of the deeper implications behind that judgment?
Yeah, great question. Thanks, Bren. I love this question. So one thing that we know from a lot of research on sociolinguistics and language ideologies, also a connected area, which is called language attitudes, is that when we are judging other people's language, we're putting ourselves in a position of superiority, and we're saying, you need to be more like me. And that doesn't, and you, it might be so hard to admit that, but if you tear back the layers, if you, like you just mentioned, if you take off the trench coat and all those layers, that's what it is at its core. So the way we use language is such a beautiful manifestation of who we are as people. And it tells all these social cues, within seconds of hearing somebody's voice. Research backs me up on this. You're doing statistics in your brain. You're thinking, where is this person from? How old are they? What's their gender? How educated are they? What kind of work do they do? So it's incredible, but you're just mapping onto your the templates in your head all this information about people. So what this means, if you peel back the layers, is that we're taking one of these beautiful, beautiful things that we have as humans to express not only our thoughts and the content of what we do, but who we are as people. And when you're judging somebody's language because they sound foreign, maybe because they sound, like they might be Native American or African American or whatever, you know, all this information, a young person, a woman, whatever, that you're actually judging that person. If you then take it further and say, oh, you know, you're a young girl and you shouldn't talk like this, what are you, you're actually not saying something about the language. What you're really saying is something about young girls and your own biases towards them. So that's a really important point to make, that when we say that somebody's talking wrong, we might think that we're doing them a favor, like, oh, let me help you. But what you're really saying is, I'm judging you as a person, and I don't think that you're good enough.
Absolutely.
That's the core message there.
Absolutely.
So let's, you ask specifically about people who are foreign. So here we're talking about people who speak English with an accent that clearly marks them as speaking English as a second language. So, okay, what did I just talk about? What we're doing is we're saying, oh, you're not one of us. So it's xenophobic, really. It's racist, it can be xenophobic. And we sort of house that or cushion it by saying, oh, but I'm trying to help you. And I think there's different ways of helping people. And when I teach in the class, I call it giving someone the hand linguistically. As a migrant myself in Finland, I feel this very deeply. You know, my Finnish clearly marks me as a foreigner. And when sometimes people literally do give you the hand when you try to speak Finnish, it feels so bad, because I think, you know, there's this famous line from, I forgot the name of the show now, this American comedy with Sofia Vergara, Modern Family. And she has this famous line, you have no idea how smart I am in Spanish. And that's how it is, like, please recognize that this is a whole person in their native language. And instead of putting that person down and saying, oh, why can't you speak proper English? You know, maybe this person speaks Punjabi and Hindi and you don't even know what else. Like, let's respect that. And the fact that they're trying to communicate with you in your mother tongue, let's applaud that instead of making the person feel terrible about it.
100%. So, yes.
That's what it comes down to. So it becomes a form of xenophobic and sort of like colonialism in your own setting, right? Like, oh, you don't speak English, right? Let me tell you.
Yes, absolutely. And that has so much impact, I think, on the field that I came from, which is teaching English as a second or a foreign language. And
absolutely.
You'll often, in my experience, because I would teach adults, I would often get students who would ask me for advice on, quote, accent reduction. And they would say, can I go to a class to, quote, reduce my accent? And I would always tell them, no, because I have an accent in my second language, which is Spanish, because of the muscles in my mouth, because of the way that I was raised speaking English. These were the inputs that I got at such an early age. And I don't want to take away the accent that marks me as who I am. And there is nothing wrong with having, quote, an accent, because every single one of us has an accent. And
Absolutely. Something
I heard once from someone, and I wish I could remember who said this, because I would love to attribute this to them, is that it's important that when you talk to someone, if you recognize that they are speaking your language as an additional language, so maybe that's not the language that they were raised with, when you hear their accent, think about how their mother sang lullabies to them as a baby, mm-hmm. and how they learned their language starting that way. They learned how to move their mouth listening to mm-hmm. their mother sing to mm-hmm. them, you know, and the muscles in their mouth formed that way. And that is what then eventually leads to an accent. And there's nothing wrong with that. All it shows is that we've been taught language by the people who cared for us.
Yeah, I think it's a really beautiful way to look at it.
I'll have to find out who said that, and I will tell you. So let's talk about some of the factors that influence language. Your book discusses several explanations posited for the existence of distinct dialects of English. What are those, in brief, explanations, and how do they combine in ways that cause us to make judgments about someone's use of language, and in this case, English?
Yeah, well, I'll maybe answer the last part of the question first. And causes to make judgments, well, like I just said, it assumes a position of power and authority Like, oh, I'm so important and I think I'm better than you. So I think I have the right to tell you how you should be speaking. Something as innate, as essential to the human condition as language. Let me just tell you how you should be doing that. You're doing it wrong. And it has the risk of cutting to the very heart of somebody, you know, that, like you just said, the lullabies that your parents sing to you. And then somebody at school or in the different settings, yeah, in more formal settings outside the home, say, oh, but the way you talk at home is wrong. I mean, what does that do to a child or to a person when you kind of rip away at this very intimate and core part of somebody's identity? So it's very, it can be very potentially damaging to people. I think it's just time that we face that reality. But you asked about some of the explanations. And the reason I included this chapter in the book where I talked about these explanations was because I had spent so much time in the previous chapters talking about why there's a standard variety and what it means, and kind of what are the drawbacks of that, what are the reasons why languages have a standard. But I wanted to make it clear, you know, if there's so much push for us all to be speaking some kind of standard variety, then why do we still have so much variation? Why don't dialects actually die out then? And they never will, because we're very different as people. And it was a difficult mental exercise, and I know there could be many other explanations, but the explanations that I thought long and hard about and ultimately wrote in the book were three different areas. The first is what I call access and isolation. I talk about prestige, particularly what has been called covert prestige. That means like in-group prestige that might not be prestigious at different levels of society, especially formal, top-down levels of society. And I think this is actually the most important, this third concept, which is identity and group identity, right? So these factors, as you pointed out in your question, they interact in many ways. So I come from the setting of the U.S. The examples that I have in the book draw largely from the U.S., so I'll stick with those examples. In the United States, we no longer have official segregation, not official, but there is definitely de facto segregation. And you see this in pretty much every major U.S. city, and the situation does not improve. You have really stark differences. You can literally cross the street in place. I used to live in Washington, D.C.
I did too.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, but you know this. You remember this?
I absolutely know. Yes.
Yeah. Like, did you ever go to Southeast? I never walked. I never went there once.
I never went there, but I know that area. And it's you're absolutely right. The difference between just two streets, one street and the street next to it, was stark.
And that's in the nation's capital. I mean, it's just so grim and so stark, like you said. So this access and isolation, and by access, what I mean is access to socioeconomic factors. Like I talked in the book about housing, education. So this is de facto segregation that goes on, and it ties to socioeconomic status. So if you look at statistics from the United States, and like the linguist John Baugh has said that this is pretty much in any developed society, we see the same kind of trends, very unfortunate trends, that race and ethnicity tend to be intertwined with a lower socioeconomic status and less socioeconomic advantage. So this you might have the idea from the outside looking in that, well, why don't you just better yourselves? Why don't you just pick up and move on? And how do you do that if you have this extreme cycle of poverty and disadvantage, and this is your everyday life? You know, it takes money, it takes ties to the outside world, it takes support to be able to pick up and leave. So I think it's quite shocking, actually, to have to acknowledge how isolated certain speech communities really are, even in the middle of a big city like Washington, D.C. And then this obviously ties into these factors like prestige. If your day-to-day life is the people around you, you know, your family, your friends who live in this community with you, there are, of course, going to be norms of linguistic prestige within that community itself that are very specific to that community, because that's the day-to-day reality. So it has nothing to do with what's happening in rooms where there's important white people or whatever, whichever way you want to envision it. And this in turn, of course, leads to enormous sense of identity about who we are. So you really see how these three factors can all intertwine. So I thought these were quite important factors. Of course, there might be others. I'd be happy to hear what other people would think about what would be some of the major reasons for why such extremely non-mainstream or non-standardized varieties continue to exist. But the key reason that keeps coming out again and again is because they mean so much to the people who speak them. They're such a huge part of the identity. And why would you possibly want to take that away? It tells the story of who they are and who their parents were and so on.
And who sang them lullabies. Exactly.
Yeah, and who sang them lullabies.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And on that, thinking about this idea of standardization and especially English. In the past 25 years, English has truly kind of exploded. And it's often been referred to as a lingua franca in today's world. What is a lingua franca for people who might not know? And what does this view of English have to do with the way, kind of as we were talking about before, that English as a second or a foreign language has been or is taught?
Yeah. Okay, great question. And this certainly ties in with your previous career.
It really does.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lingua franca, it means some kind of a vehicular language, a language that you try to use to find common ground when you don't share a mother tongue or maybe even a second language. And in today's world, this has become English because English is just there. So I talked earlier about how Finland is an officially bilingual country, constitutionally bilingual. You might be shocked to find out that it's increasingly common for Swedish speakers and Finnish speakers here in Finland to speak English with each other. And I understand that we the same thing is happening in Belgium now as well, another officially bilingual country, trilingual actually. So yeah, multilingual Europe, there we go. Does it really mean just speaking English in addition to the other languages? But anyway, that's what English as a lingua franca is. It means that English has emerged as this language that people can use as a medium of communication when there's no other logical choice available. You asked how it compares to English as a second language or a foreign language, and it does differ in very important ways. One of the things that I really appreciate, we call this the ELF movement, not to be confused with, Saul people or people from Lord of the Rings or whatever.
Speaking of Santa.
Yes, exactly. Can't get over that theme, right?
Exactly.
So ELF, we do call it ELF, and it stands for English as a lingua franca. And it differs in its ideology very, very much from second language acquisition and foreign language teaching, because English as a lingua franca, the principles are that it's something that people have, that you're a user of English as a lingua franca, an ELF speaker, but you're not an ELF learner. So it's not something that is, okay, you need to do this and this and this to be able to speak it well. That's more tied up with the principles of English as a second language. But English as a lingua franca, the principles are that people have their language background. You know, you might be a German speaker, and then you're speaking English as an additional language, and you meet somebody from, I don't know, Taiwan, and then they merge, and each one will bring characteristics from their mother tongue, and it's not seen as being error-based. So I remember studying second language acquisition when I was in graduate school in the United States, and there were all these error-based models, and, you know, here's the native speaker norm, and let's compare it, and, oh, the second language speaker got this wrong, and this wrong, and this wrong. We were always talking about mistakes and errors, and it was a really prescriptivist view is what we would call that. But with English as a lingua franca, it's just, look, this is what this person brings in, and this is what this person brings in, and somehow they manage. And I really appreciate that the ELF research is kind of just trying to celebrate what a success story this tends to be, that people are so, you think of it as bringing out the goodness in people, that people want to communicate. So they're trying to find common ground. They're trying to understand each other, and nobody's really in a position of authority. So another thing that characterizes elf conversations is that native speakers like you or me, we wouldn't necessarily have an advantage. That we would be another elf speaker, and that we wouldn't be able to say, oh, well, I speak English right. You should gravitate towards me. Because the research shows that very often people who are using English as a lingua franca, they understand each other, especially if they had a shared language background, they understand each other better than they would understand certainly somebody from Glasgow or Aberdeen or, you know, inner Baltimore or whatever.
Or outback Australia. Yes.
Yes. Like, yes.
Exactly. Yes. That is what is so interesting to me, mm-hmm. especially coming from a background of teaching English as a second, and sometimes I taught as a foreign language, and just seeing the ways that people naturally were able to understand each other. And it was almost like watching language evolve in real time. And I think that that's just so fascinating. And like you said, that's something to really be celebrated, because as humans, we're able to do that. And how awesome is that? And like you said, it's not about prescriptivism or errors. It's about saying, wow, look at them. We can communicate with each other and potentially make something new.
And it's about ownership. And it really pivoted the kind. It's important to point out that we as lecturers, as scientists, as teachers of English, we're a victim to our own ideologies. And that's an ideology that just did a complete pivot.
It really is. It really is. Yeah. And I'd like to ask you the following question, because I asked this to other guests that we have on the show. What do you feel is something that generally monolingual English speakers get wrong, just kind of in general, when they think about people from non-English speaking backgrounds who learn to speak English?
Yeah, this ties in with something we talked about before with giving somebody the hand. And one of the most hurtful things is that, we tend to associate language with thought. And this is what a lot of people who are interested in linguistics as lay people, they really think that there's this belief that, a rather widespread popular belief, actually, that we think through language. So therefore, if somebody has kind of a learner way of speaking English, we somehow think that they're not a whole person, or that they're maybe kind of stupid, or they can't think straight. And that's so belittling. Do you see what I mean? That, you know, there, if this person can't speak my language correctly, if I, you know, if somebody really has that standard language ideology, they think that English should only be spoken this way. And then here's somebody who's trying to communicate and use English that they've learned later in life, that you might not value what that person has to say, and just think, this person has no credibility. This person's stupid. Listen, they can't even speak. Not recognizing that this person has a rich linguistic repertoire. Everybody has a full language capability in their mother tongue. So I think that's something really important. What else could I say? I think that very often, because of these ideologies that native speakers have, people from the inner circle, they don't question language in this, or the English language, in the same way that people do who have acquired it later in life or through different means. So we have all kinds of inaccurate things that we believe about language, about the English language in particular, that just don't hold up to scrutiny. Like when I've been visiting North Carolina, that's where I wrote this book, actually. I had a research leave in North Carolina. It was wonderful. And somebody there told me that, well, did you know that they speak like Shakespeare here in the Appalachian Mountains? And I was like, no, they don't. Yeah, they do. There's these communities there, and they still speak like Shakespeare. They speak Shakespeare's English there because it's so isolated. Nah.
Not quite.
Yeah. So just these folk ideas that say a lot, but they don't necessarily say truths about language. Those are always interesting to hear. I think we touched on something previously as well when we talked about English as a lingua franca, and that is that standard English would somehow be logical or superior or easier to understand. And that's not the case either, as we've just discussed. Not necessarily true, but those are just other varieties. They happen to have more social prestige for some people. That's the only thing that makes them special. I think those are some of the most important things that come to my mind.
I agree. And honestly, I think it's worth coming back to that image of the four languages standing on top of each other in a trench coat. When we think about people who do learn English, especially later in life, truly English, you know, when we think about it, it's just such a hodgepodge of other languages, of other influences. You can see the history that has happened within English, and to expect people to be able to do all of that as they learn English, to be able to do everything, quote, correctly, when we think about how difficult English can be, is just, you're right. It's not fair, and it demeans them as a whole person.
And have you noticed as well that sometimes you get the feeling that it's never enough, that the carrot is ever dangled higher, that, okay, you can do that, but you still don't sound like this person. So it's like this, which even as native speakers, we're forced to kind of achieve this impossible target. And native speakers can certainly have those insecurities as well. Like studies from Americans showing that, oh, I don't speak good English. They speak better English in Britain. I mentioned that in chapter one of the book. So this insecurity that even somebody who has English as their mother tongue, this is what standard language ideology does to people.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. And before we wrap up, I could talk to you forever, but I guess we do have to wrap up eventually. Can you tell us what's next for you and your work?
Yeah, I love this question. I'm really excited to tell you about a project that I've had for a few months now, which is called Language Awareness and Ideologies in Finland. It's funded by the Kone Foundation, which is a private foundation here based in Finland. Even in Australia, though, you might see lifts and escalators made by this company. It's called K-O-N-E, okay? So we have this project funded by them. And I you could say that this book was really a stepping stone for me. And we certainly see this movement in linguistics, and especially sociolinguistics in particular. And you folks there, I mean, you're doing such wonderful work. So anyway, the Kone Foundation, their chief motto is make the world a better place. And I love that. And kind of the way our project runs is where you want to make the world a better place through language, right? So we're working on addressing the tension and the fear that people feel in Finland about the Finnish language being at risk because of the input of English. This is a real fear with these language communities here in Europe and elsewhere, of course. But we're dealing with this in Finland. I have some brilliant postdocs, a PhD researcher, and one thing that makes our project stand out is that we have a dedicated science communicator, a public relations person who is making that liaison between our science and the public. So we're hearing more and more about how we need to do this, build in social impact. And yeah, we're getting going with the project, and it's really exciting to have that. So as I said before, just pointing out the richness of English is not enough, that it's time to redress the social injustices. So I feel like we're just part of a larger movement. There's lots of folks in the US, Australia, and so on, who are really trying to put our money where our mouth is, so to speak, with our science and making the world a better place through language. So that's what's up. Get out of the lab and out of the ivory tower and talk to people, talk to the people, get our message out there, what we have known about language for decades. Get that message out there. I also have a new book on the topic. It's called English in the Nordic Countries. That's open access. It's an anthology, so chapters that are talking about this tension and these challenges that the Nordic countries in particular seem to feel is such a problem now, that how do we protect Icelandic, how do we protect Danish, and so on, when English is making such inroads into all these different levels of our society. So that's what I've been up to. Lots of exciting stuff. It's so fun to be a linguist.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. I cannot wait to follow your work and to just kind of see how you keep going. It sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. And it's just been an absolute delight to talk to you.
I feel the same way. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to our channel, leave a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, and recommend the Language on the Move podcast and our partner, the New Books Network, to your students, colleagues, and friends. Till next time.